I thank my good friend, the governor of Illinois, for presenting me to his fellow governors. I'd looked at the program originally, Dan, and it said that Wendell was going to present me, not Wendell Anderson, but Wendell Ford. And I had a note down here that I like governors by the name of Wendell. So I'm going to use that. And I do, Wendy. I want you to know that. And I'm very honored to be privileged to be here today with each and every one of you that are in attendance here, as well as those that I hope that you'll give those that left here for other business my very good wishes and greetings. I'm pleased to see so many members of your staff, or of your respective staffs here, because what I have to say to you today, I think will relate to their responsibilities as well as our own responsibilities. Chairman Strauss is here and is going to give you a splendid message relating to the condition of our party and what our responsibilities and opportunities are. He's also reminded me that he has to catch a plane, but he didn't say which day. And since he was not so precise, I'm not going to be at all either intimidated or limited by what I want to say or how long I want to say it. Let me talk to you very openly and candidly as a friend and as a fellow Democrat. First of all, you're looking at a man that absolutely wants nothing from this party except its success. You're looking at a man that has had many wonderful opportunities made possible by the Democratic Party. And you're looking at a man that has truly enjoyed his opportunity to serve in public life. I, of course, have some feelings of remorse and unhappiness over the fact that when I was privileged to be your standard bearer in the national election, we were not successful. We came close, very close, close enough to surprise our friends and, may I say, even to worry our opposition. But close doesn't count in our work. You have to be on target, and you have to win. But when I say you have to win, I think it's also important that we win honorably, that we win with purpose. I've always thought of our friend Adlai Stevenson, not only when I come to Illinois, but other places, because I have the belief that he was truly great in his defeat, that he brought tremendous respect to politics and honor to himself and his country, because of the manner in which he conducted himself, the high quality of his performance and his message, the sense of dignity that he always maintained, and yet that sense of good humor, which is so vital in public and public affairs. So today you honor me very much by letting me come here to talk to you. And I want to talk to you as just another servant in the vineyard of our party and of our country above all. I'm more interested in our country, frankly, than I am in our party, but I happen to believe that the country is generally best served when the Democratic Party is given the privilege and the burden of leadership. So it's within that framework that I want to talk to you, not as an oration, which I would love to give, but as just a discussion. I guess it's fair to say that we come here at a crucial juncture for the Democratic Party and for our nation. We know that the November elections in 74 are just slightly more than 6 months away. The presidential elections of 1976, the election of 76 looms over the horizon just 2.5 years into the future. And every one of us that's in politics knows how fast time seems to fly. For the men and women who lead the Democratic Party in Congress, in the state houses, in legislatures, in our cities and counties, the period from now until November 1976 will be a crucial time of testing. And I think that's the way we have to look at it. We all are going to face a very, very important test, and it will be in the public arena, open for all to judge and to grade. We'll have to prove to the American people that we can respond. And I repeat, that we can respond to their real needs, and that we can and know how to govern for our country. We'll have to prove that this great economy of ours can be made healthy once again. And as Democrats, we must prove that we can govern the nation honestly and fairly, permitting no favor for the powerful and showing compassion for the weak. Don't be ashamed of having a sense of heart or compassion. As important as efficiency is in government, more important is justice. The word efficiency has not to be found in any of the great documents of human history. It's neither in the Old or the New Testament, nor in the Magna Carta, or the Constitution of the United States, or the Declaration of Independence, or the Emancipation Proclamation. But my fellow public servants, the words justice and love, of service and humility, of compassion and kindness, are there again and again. And it's this kind of thinking and philosophy that I would emphasize. Now, if we pass these tests, we can transform a substantial congressional majority, which I am confident we'll have as a result of the elections in 74, into a presidential victory. But I say that I'm confident that we'll have that overwhelming majority in the next Congress. To put it very simply, I once, in talking to our friends in the labor movement, said I think we can get a veto-proof Congress. But then if we get it, there can be no excuses for any failure on our part to perform and to act. And remember this, Richard Nixon will not be running in 1976. It will be a Republican who has systematically moved away a safe distance and has put that safe distance between himself and the Nixon crowd. That Republican will be on the attack. They're going to be looking at everything we do and don't do, exploiting any weakness in our political armor. So 74 is but winning a battle. The real struggle will be determined in 76. And it's those two crucial years that are the testing period. So to put it bluntly, 74 and 1974 and 75 are the years of decision. And the difficult years, but they're also the years of opportunity. I have never looked at difficulties and problems, but what I found that they were also a chance for challenges and opportunities. In the next 2 years, we'll either pass the test demonstrating that we're capable of effective action and the restoration of trust, or we're going to forfeit our claim to progressive political leadership. Now, it will do a little good for any of us to tell the American people what could be done if a Democrat were now sitting in the White House today. Oh, I have people come to me all the time and say, well, I think if you'd have been there, Hubert, it'd have been different and so on. Well, I said, I am not there. And I have a feeling that some of them that said that weren't there either when I needed them. Nor will future promises of what may be possible after 76 serve us very well. We're going to be on the spot. The people expect and demand of our party to act, and to act decisively. The whole purpose of life is action. Not just to philosophize, but to act. And you can't wait for all of the evidence to come in when you're in this political arena. You sometimes have to act even when you don't have all the information you would like. They expect us to act decisively to solve their problems from positions of trust and the responsibility that we will hold. So I say this is not an ordinary election year, and our nation does not face just ordinary problems. Believe me, the party in power has made ordinary problems very, very serious and complex problems. After many long years of dissension at home and in war overseas, the American people have witnessed a series of unbelievable events which every day erodes their confidence and faith and trust in government. We have seen the bounty of our great nation mismanaged at home, and we've seen some of it squandered for short-term advantage abroad. We've seen our economy neglected and distorted. We've seen shortages and scarcity grow from private greed and government short-sightedness. We have seen our constitutional system of delicate checks and balances dangerously tilted in favor of one branch of government at the expense of all others. We've seen our political processes corrupted. We have seen political power abused, and money abused as a means of buying power. We've seen highly placed trustees of our government openly betray their trust and act as if they were above the law. In fact, gentlemen, they have acted as if they were the law. The unprecedented corruption and governmental mismanagement of the Nixon administration, of course, offers us Democrats a unique political opportunity. Everybody says that, you know. And the stench of Watergate will have a direct effect, I'm sure, upon the immediate elections. And we must not forget, however, that it was a Republican president who used his ill-gotten electoral mandate, and I repeat, his ill-gotten electoral mandate, to limit or demolish the efforts of this party for the past 20 to 25 years to achieve greater social justice and progress in human rights. To me, the great crime of the Nixon administration is its neglect of the people, its unwillingness to respond to human need, its willingness to buy and sell anything. We now have the responsibility and the opportunity, those of us here in this room and others like us, to muster the will and the vision to clean up this sorry mess and to govern America so that the people can once again believe in and trust their government. Because without trust and faith of the people in their government, there can be no democratic government. It's trust that is the binding that holds all of this together, government by the consent of the governed. But the job to be done and the challenges to be faced are not only in Washington, as you men here, the great governors of our states, know. They're in every state, every county and municipality. You know, the American people don't compartmentalize government. They just talk about government. When they talk about taxes, they're talking about all kinds of taxes. When they're talking about government, they're talking about all kinds of government. When they get discouraged and disgusted with corruption in government, they are talking about all kinds of government and all kinds of people in government. I think we need to remember that. Remember that the stench of this administration literally permeates everything in American society today. And each and every one of us are looked upon with some suspicion. I think it would be less than fair if we didn't say that. Public disillusionment with government and political parties occurs at the time when the Democratic Party seems to be emerging from a decade of internal strife, division, and turmoil. I could give you quite a statement on that. I lived through that time. The long night of our despair, thank God, seems to be over. And I want to say that I think this man to my right and your left here, our national chairman, has done more than any man to try to bring this long night of despair to an end and to bring us some sense of unity. No matter what you read or what people say, we are no longer a divided party. We're no longer divided over a war. We are no longer a locked and fierce battle over who should run our party. We have pulled together as good as Democrats ever can. We're an independent lot, a lot, and sometimes rather ornery. But life itself is not a smooth course. And we're a lively party with the times. Now, Democrats on Capitol Hill, and I think I can represent some of their thought at least here, must now work closely with party leaders at all levels of government to fashion a Democratic program for the Congress and for the Democrats at the national level. A program which allow Democrats to go to the American people with a message. Now, sometimes those of us at Capitol Hill get to thinking that, you know, that we're it. But I've been in local government, and I happen to believe that most people identify very closely with what's going on at home. And we need the input, not only the input, the guidance and the direction of people like in this room. Just as you need to work with us. We need closer collaboration. When I was your vice president, I tried to do something about that, working with legislative leaders and governors. Only because I have grown up in politics and know that it doesn't come from on top. It comes from the bottom on up. So as we try to figure out what we ought to be saying, maybe it should go something like this. We see how skyrocketing inflation destroys wage increases and making it impossible for families to make ends meet. And we've got to go to the American people and say we're ready to act. We see how you pay your fair share of taxes, while some Americans take advantage of gaping tax loopholes, and we're ready to act. We've got to say in these simple words, we see how your family can be wiped out by medical bills when one member of the family is afflicted with serious illness, and we are ready to act. And we see months of joblessness and constant threat of layoff demoralizing your family, and we're ready to act. We see how your children may be denied a college education because you just can't afford the high costs, and we're ready to act. What I'm saying is, my fellow Democrats, we've got to relate to the people, not to the columnist, but to the people. There isn't any new politics. It's the same thing it's always been. If it's good politics, it's the politics of the people. Finding out what bothers them, what concerns them, and then responding to it. Instead of getting off in some esoteric end run that has an appeal to a few snobs, I suggest that we remember where we come from, who we are, and who we're here to serve. That Constitution starts out by saying, we the people. Doesn't say we the editors, or we the columnists, or we the professors. It says we the people. And if we spend our time thinking about people and what people need, what they want, and who they are, and where they are, and how they're living, they're going to be with us. But you go around here chasing off these super-duper mythological ideas that are off in the far stretches, we're going to get just what we deserve. We're going to get bounced, defeated. I feel very strongly about this because I sometimes think that rather than we, the leaders of this party, working with the people and coming forth with program, listen to people who are not in this party, who've never done anything for this party, who don't intend to do anything for this party, to start to set our standards. I want us to set our own standards, and I want them high, and I want them pro-people. And let's not be ashamed of it. Because that's what's going to take to, that's what's going to take to make this a better country. We got to develop a program of legislative action which meets the needs of the average working family. That's where your votes are, and that's where the strength of this nation lies. And which recognizes the values on the one hand of self-reliance, and on the other hand of governmental incentive. And this program will demonstrate that we don't need an abdication of Republican leadership to win. We don't even need a Watergate to win. And we ought not to have one to win. We ought not to have to fall in the sewer in order to come out, hopefully, and to face the public and then say, we want to lead you. We ought to be able to govern sensibly and fairly in the name of all the people and know what people need and want and be willing to work with them to achieve it. Now, what are some of the issues in the Democratic agenda? Well, I'll put it right down first because I think this is the first issue. Democrats must take immediate action to preserve the hard-won economic gains that American families have earned over the years, despite the frequent economic setbacks during this Nixon administration. This means that the first issue is the economic issue, to meet the needs of the average family. This means the enactment of a strong anti-recession and anti-inflation legislative package. And we're not going to listen to or let other people be conned by all of this soothing syrup gobbledygook that comes from high places in Washington, D.C. The fact is, the cruel irony of unchecked double-digit inflation combined with rising levels of unemployment affecting millions of Americans must be halted. The specter of a drop of almost 6% in the value of the gross national product, as was reported this weekend, an unprecedented 10.25% in prime interest rates, a rise in the cost of living of almost 11% in a year, a staggering rise in the wholesale price index of 19% in the last year, which will translate itself into ever-increased prices at the retail level, and an incredible drop of 12% in real weekly spendable earnings. These last 3 months, these are the cruel and shocking facts of Republican rule. And here is the issue. And we must have the courage and the boldness to take action. I remember what Franklin Roosevelt once said. He said, act. Take action. If what you do doesn't work, try something else. But do it. And I'm not for one of these that just simply sits around and says, well, now let's see. It may work itself out. The people that say that are already very safe and secure. They've got enough so that they could stand five depressions. But the folks that you and I know, most of them can't stand a month of it. And you take a look at what's happening. You know, you're the governors, you're out there in the states, you're closer to the people than any other group of political leaders in America. So I suggest that the first thing that we have the courage to do is to recognize that a lot of low-income people in this country and middle-income people, and don't forget middle-income people, are put on the economic rack by this administration, which I say will buy anything and sell anything, which knows one word, profit, and never has understood the word service. We're going to have the courage, and it's going to take some, to reduce taxes for low and middle income families as a way of getting this economy back to work again. Don't you judge this economy by the profits of Exxon. Don't you judge this economy by the profits of the leading of the top 20 banks. That does not tell what's going on in America. What tells what's going on in America is what's happening to that person out there in that shop or that factory or in that business place or that store or out there in rural America. That's what tells the story. The reduction in the revenue being that we have from this reduction in taxes can be offset by elimination or sharp reduction of such items as oil depletion allowance, foreign tax credits, and strengthening the minimum tax. No person in this country ought to ever be of any income, of any sizable income, ought to be permitted to be without payment of some tax. We also have to have a public employment program. I hope Democrats understand the importance of constructive work. I am weary of those who complain only of welfare and unwilling to put people to work to do what this country needs done. And a public service employment program is necessary, including the improvement, of course, of unemployment compensation. We can pay for this program, and I'll tell you how, by a very modest reduction in defense spending. And I do not join with those that say that we ought not to be concerned about our security. I am concerned. I know something about it. I'm the only member of Congress that's ever served on the National Security Council. So I am interested in our defense. But I tell you, that defense budget is bloated as if somebody had eaten a barrel of cucumbers. We need a government program to make credit more readily available to consumer borrowers, to small businesses, including home builders, to state and local governments, and to home buyers. Listen, my good friends of the Democratic Party, your government comes in and every administration comes in and says you've got to make another contribution to the World Bank. Right now we're talking about $1.5 billion for the International Development Association. I happen to believe that these are responsibilities that we have to fulfill. But if we've got a bank that is willing to loan money to Rio de Janeiro, or some community off in Afghanistan, or some place down in Bangladesh, at lower rates of interest than we're willing to loan money to Baltimore, or to Philadelphia, or to Newark, or to Louisville, or to some community here in Chicago, or Joliet, Illinois, I think there's something wrong. We need, again, in this country, something called a National Domestic Development Bank to provide a system of long-term financing for the programs of public benefit in this nation, to help states and localities, to help consumer borrowers. I'm about to come to the point where it seems to me that we have to understand that our ability to contribute to international organization will depend upon our ability to produce the revenue here at home and the prosperity that can pay for those costs. We need a permanent mechanism to administer a set of largely voluntary wage price policies. This mechanism is badly needed at the present, because of the present system and how poorly it's been managed on wage and price controls. This program, as you know, is coming to an end. And I think we ought to have, for any president, limited standby authority to reimpose wage and price controls if needed on particular sectors of the economy. Now, I know some of my friends in the labor movement are not going to be happy about that. And I understand that. That's their job. But I'm a public servant. My job is to think about what is good for the total economy. I don't happen to believe that we ought to have massive price and wage control. But I'll tell you what I'll predict. That comes April 30th and all these controls go off, you'll see inflation like you've never seen it in all your life. Everybody is going to take advantage because there is no guarantee of what the future policy of this country is going to be. And the folks that are going to get hurt are the folks you know, folks that you are concerned about that are going to be rapping at your door, Governor, the ordinary folks of this country. Democrats must take, in other words, immediate action to bring equity, sanity, and reform to the American tax system. The tax abuses of our president only highlight the need to act. And no other issue goes so directly to the fundamental moral question concerning the uneven distribution of wealth in America. Now, I've outlined here in my text some things that I think we can do. I shan't burden you with it. Take a look at it. What I'm suggesting, by the way, just some of my ideas, they're not worth any more than that. I know that. But we need to talk to each other. We need to exchange these ideas. We need to accommodate ourselves to each other. We need to listen to you, and you need to listen to me, and I need to listen to others. We can't afford to have some little select group get off over here and draw us up a platform and say, here it is. I think we know more about what people are talking about as elected public officials than any group of refined intellectuals or anybody else, and I happen to believe that we need intellectuals. But our job as political men and women is to be close to the people. I think Democrats must take immediate action to provide every American family with a system of national health insurance, which at a minimum would protect families against catastrophic illness. What are we waiting for? I just read over this weekend a piece in the New York Times of 1950, not 1974, when I was a co-sponsor of a comprehensive national health insurance program with Senator Murray of Montana, Congressman Dingell of Michigan, and other senators. I've been for it for 24 years. And I'm still for it, and I'm going to be around when we get it. The party that gave Medicare to the elderly, and that's our party, should now provide a comprehensive system of child and maternal health care for the nation's children and mothers. Medicare for grandpa and grandma, kitty care for ma and the kids, at a minimum. Let's remember what kind of a party we are. And as Congress considers this plan for health insurance, we're going to have to step up our programs in medical research and health manpower programs and champion the programs designed to serve the mentally and the physically handicapped. I want to tell you something about this man, Mr. Nixon. When he vetoed our program in the Congress to provide a five-year program to aid the physically and the mentally handicapped and said he did it because it was inflationary, I considered that the most cruel and obnoxious veto in the history of the American presidency. And I shall never forgive him for it. And I don't want you Democrat leaders to ever forgive him for it. If you can't be concerned about the physically handicapped, the mentally ill, and the mentally retarded, you ought to get out of public office. And I have a reason to think the fellow that's in there ought to get out. We're a party that cares. That's what we say. Let's prove it. And let's not be just standing around here arguing over commas and semicolons. Let's prove it. Now on energy. That's another issue that people are concerned about. Oh, today it's fine. They say everything's jolly. Now, every one of you in this room knows that for the next 5 years, at a minimum, there's going to be an energy crunch. The good Lord himself cannot build a refinery in less than 3 to 5 years. Now, the Democratic Party has a majority in the Congress, and we're going to have a bigger one. We've got to come down on an energy policy. We can't just say, well, Nixon stood in our way. And even if we can't pass it, we ought to design it and then make it clear to the public what we've been trying to do. I happen to think we need a department in this government of energy and natural resources. I think we need an office of research and development of fuels. I think we need to pour it on in terms of research and development, this business of talking about project independence and then leaving it there as if it was a Madison Avenue ad, a 10-second spot on television, does not answer the needs. And I'm not willing to let it just rest in the hands of the private oil companies as much as they will develop and explore. Government has a responsibility, and I've outlined some of the things here that I think the government can do. I want us to put the muscle to, so to speak, the resources to solar energy research. There's much that we can do. Let's have some vision. Remember once that a president advocated a Tennessee Valley Authority. It didn't destroy the private utilities. But I'll tell you what it did. It rebuilt a whole section of the country. And I'll tell you what else it did. It acted as a yardstick to show what a reasonable price for utility rates ought to be. We may very well need some kind of quasi-public corporation in public lands and the public domains to take those resources that are there and develop them for the public good as a yardstick to show what can be done. Think it over. Now, you governors have been doing some darn good thinking about this. I happen to believe that had it not been for the governors and their initiatives, Republicans and Democrats alike, we'd never gotten through this energy business that we've had this last winter. It was the governors that took the lead. The president made some speeches in between other things he was doing. I thought you'd let that sink in just a minute. But it was the governors that advocated the different proposals that we had, the odd and even days, and all the things that had to be done, which proves again that you're capable of bringing to the national scene the good advice. Do you remember the days, some of you do not, but some of you may from your studies, remember the days of Al Smith, when we used to talk about Al Smith? We used to say that his greatness as a governor was that his programs were a laboratory for America. The New Deal was born with Al Smith. Back in the state of Wisconsin, may I say that many of the great social programs had their genesis, starting in a state legislature, starting back there, starting back, if you please, in our own state of Minnesota, in the Farmer Labor Party and the Democratic Party of those years. And it's true all over America. We don't have to have everything come out of Washington. It's sometimes much better when it's been tested at the state level. When a governor has shown his leadership and a legislature has responded, and we've tried it. You see, I often thought we ought to have tried this family assistance program at the state level. That rather than moving all at once on a great national program, we should have tried it in several key areas to get a look at it, to see how it works. If we need testing in the laboratory for drugs or medications, if we need testing in the laboratory for firm forms of medical care, sometimes we need to look at states and localities as laboratories for the testing of social programs and economic programs. Now, on food, you know, I know that it almost seems incredible to be in the state of Illinois, this great agricultural state as well as industrial state out here in the Midwest, and talk about the possibilities of a food crisis. Well, mark my words, governors. The next crisis that faces the world, and we'll be involved in it if it faces the world, is the food crisis. And it's worse and will be worse than the energy crisis. Because, of course, the shortage of energy contributes to the shortage of food, because energy relates to fertilizer, fertilizer relates to food production. This government does not have a national food policy. We need one. We need to be sure that Mr. Farmer is not the victim of boom and bust. Today we ask him to produce everything. Maybe he will someday momentarily produce too much and his markets fade away. We need reserves. This administration that talks about national security forgets what Napoleon once said. And Napoleon knew a lot about fighting wars. He said an army travels on its stomach. Food is a new weapon for good. Food is life. Food is power. Food is our ace in the hole in the international economic community. And this administration has no national food policy. I spend practically half of my time on this. A gentleman, I might say immodestly, that I think I know of what I speak. We need food reserves just like we need strategic reserves of metals. And might I say to this group of governors, you better take a look at what this government's doing to our national strategic stockpile of metals. They have drawn them down to a point where our national security is endangered. Because they like to make the budget look good. They're bookkeepers, accountants. I happen to have respect for bookkeepers and accountants. You should hire them, not elect them. Experts should be on tap, not on top. At home, we're confronted with continuously rising food prices. Yet our farmers are facing increased production costs and limited supplies of essential materials such as fertilizer, as well as severe constraints in moving their commodities from farm to market. When is the Democratic Party going to be interested in transportation? Are you going to wait till all the railroad lines are abandoned in rural America? And then you that are the governors of great metropolitan states will wring your hands about the high price of food. The transportation system of this country is obsolete and outmoded. And I want the Democratic Party to come alive. I want us to think through what needs to be done, and there are better answers than nationalization. Let's think about it. Abroad, millions of people in the developing nations face the threat of hunger and starvation. And yet we are unable to meet some of these desperate needs. I've called for a sound and sensible food policy that will emphasize the adequacy of food for our consumers and will protect the farmer from the boom and bust cycle of sharply fluctuating prices. So my food policy would be a food and fiber reserve, a system to monitor and supervise export sales so that we can meet our food needs at home and be reliable suppliers in our export markets. A universal school feeding program of at least one good nutritious meal a day. The assurance of adequate and wholesome food for our elderly and our needy. And gentlemen, governors gathered in this room, we do not have that kind of a policy today. In many of your states, your school lunch program's in trouble right now. And finally, Democrats should take action to design and institute a system of long-range policy planning in Congress and in the executive branch. Stopgap solutions to long-range problems are at the heart of public discontent. These emergency measures are wasteful. They have no relevance to long-term needs. The federal government presently has absolutely no means to identify future problems and plan solutions which go beyond the 1 or 2 year budgetary outlay. And by the way, have any of you governors ever been consulted on the federal budget? Whoever becomes the Democratic nominee for president in 76 and when he's elected, I am going to insist, and I hope you will help me, that we open up the budget process of the federal government, that we start to listen to people who know what's going on. That budget is the most secret document. Don't worry about the Pentagon Papers. That was like Sears and Roebuck catalog. Nobody ever gets to see that budget until it comes down to the Congress of the United States. It comes there like Holy Writ, as if it was a rediscovered Dead Sea Scroll. It comes there bound in wax. And it is there, and it comes down almost like an executive edict. I happen to believe that that budget, as it's prepared in a year in advance, ought to be a budget that gets your input, and the input of a mayor, and of a labor group, and of a business group, and of a farm group, and of some teachers, and doctors, and consumers, and so forth. No, it's all done by people who have a passion for anonymity. How you can be anonymous and be passionate at the same time is beyond me. But it's done in the in-house work of the Office of Management and Budget. Good people, competent people, but they should refine the budget after the public servants have made their input into that budget and the public has had a chance. So I want to see better planning, whether it's in housing, health, transportation, agriculture, or a host of other areas. We have no way today, gentlemen, to assess future needs and prepare an adequate response. We're playing catch-up ball all the time. I believe that any Democratic legislative agenda, therefore, must include the enactment of a balanced National Growth and Development Act to provide government at all levels with better planning to make rational decisions on how our nation should grow and how policymakers should organize government to meet future needs. Even Dr. Stein of the President's Council on Economic Advisors now agrees with this. And the other day I had lunch with Roy Ash of the Office of Management and Budget, and he has not turned it down flatly. They're beginning to see it. But the problem is in our own party. We're still trying to redo Roosevelt. I suggest that we honor that great president for what he accomplished and build on what was done and seek to plow some new ground, to build some new structures, and not to be caught up in the past and merely with an attack upon the mismanagement of Republicans. Listen, I've always known Republicans didn't know how to run the government. That's nothing new. And for us to go out around the country and merely point out that every time they get in power, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Every time that they get in power, that they louse up the economy. Everybody has known that since the time of Herbert Hoover. What I think people want to know is what we're for. What we're for. They presume that you as a Democratic governor are against the Republicans. They presume that Hubert Humphrey might be against many of the Republican programs. They ought to, because I think politics ought to be a sincere philosophical difference. Now, once they presume that we are opposed to some of the things that are being done, then they have a right to ask, what are we going to do? I know today we could spend much time on campaign election reform. Our Congress is doing that. Make no mistake about it, there will be reform. And make no mistake about it, big money has to be removed. And the only answer to big money, once it's removed, is some forms of public financing, or a mixture of public and private with severe limitations on the amount of contributions, with the most independent, competent, and consistent investigation and monitoring of election practices. Now, what I've said, I don't consider an agenda for a party platform. You know what happens to platforms? Somebody said they're made to run on, not to work on. They collect dust. What I've tried to talk about is a program of action. I want to see these proposals have the light of day. I think they have to be debated and considered by the people's representatives. These are just some suggestions. You have many more. But we need to talk out loud to each other and talk at each other and argue about it. But even if Democrats in Congress develop a progressive legislative agenda, it isn't going to be enough. We've got to modernize the institution of Congress, and you've got to help us. Back in 1966, 42% of the American people expressed a great deal of confidence in Congress. When that same question was asked here just recently, only 21% responded in the same fashion. Now, that ought to signal something to somebody. And what the American people are sensing of the Congress is that its machinery is not quite organized to meet the problems of the day. Its machinery is inadequate. In other words, it would be like trying to take a 747 off the runway with a DC-3 engine. But we got folks in Congress that just love the DC-3. Why, their father flew on the DC-3. Their grandfather stepped into the cockpit. Their children have seen the DC-3. And if it was good enough for grandfather and dad and mom and my children have seen it, it's good enough for the rest of us. Baloney. I've been in Congress now for over 20 years, and I happen to believe that it needs updating just exactly as we reorganize the executive branch of government, just as we have to go into our state organizations and rewrite constitutions and reorganize your state governments, and most of you here have done it. But the Congress of the United States refuses, up till now, to come to grips with its own inadequacies. And I lay it on the line. I say to my fellow Democrats that unless we're willing to break tradition, we're going to suffer. And what could be great victories will be hairline decisions or losses. The 20th century Congress cannot be content with employing 19th century technology. And if the Congress is to be taken seriously by the public or the president, it must make itself truly a co-equal and effective branch. What do I suggest? Greater use of the caucus so that we come to some understanding of a program and a timetable